I'd like to talk about rejection and particle filtering for Hamiltonian learning applications. But first, to do so, I really have to say a little bit about what I mean by a Hamiltonian. This word's been used a lot so far today. It has a lot of different meanings, a lot of different applications. You know, we can talk about characterizing ground states of a system. We can talk about characterizing thermal sampling. But here I'll talk about exactly one meaning for a Hamiltonian, something that generates dynamics. Sorry, there's a slight AV issue. Sorry, I'm having a slight AV issue. So here I've got an initial state, I evolve under Hamiltonian for some time t, and then I get a final state. So in this way, the Hamiltonian is what describes the unitary evolution from one state to another. And learning what this Hamiltonian is critical to a wide range of different tasks in quantum information. It's important to metrology, in that this describes what it means to measure a magnetic field or to build quantum systems. It's important to calibration, where if you have some control in a quantum system and you want to know what that control is doing, if you're trying to isolate, say, crosstalk into your system from a couple of classical wires going into your fridge that are too near each other, then that shows up as a term in your Hamiltonian and in the dynamics such that learning that helps you build better control. Once you build control, Hamiltonian learning gives you a way of debugging and diagnosing problems with that control, such as estimating the noise processes in your system, finding what your T2 is, finding if there are other couplings to the bath, for instance. And then finally, we've heard a fair bit now about quantum simulation as being a compelling use for quantum information in the first place. But the idea there is we want to build something we can't reason about classically. And so we don't know if the Hamiltonian or simulation, or simulators implement is correct. And so we need to think of that as how do we learn what our simulators are actually doing. Just as an example of what I mean by Hamiltonian learning and the idea that's common to all those applications, let's just run through a simple example. This goes by a lot of different names like Rabi estimation or Ramsey estimation, where we have a Hamiltonian that is proportional to sigma z with some unknown constant of proportionality. Here a frequency, we'll call it omega. And the traditional approach is to prepare a state that's in superposition, let it evolve, and measure it for some time t, and measure a click back. So we get either 0, 1, we either return to the initial state or not, with a cosine. And then we can repeat that for many different shots at each time to estimate what the probability there is. And then we can repeat that many different times to build up a signal that'll look something like this. And here, as we take 1, 10, and 100 shots at each one of those times, those individual data points start to approach a true signal that is described by that cosine. And if we take a Fourier transform of that and look at the peak, well, we can see a peak here. I chose 70.3 megahertz to be what I generated this from. And that peak is pretty close. We're actually gaining some information about the dynamics of that system by estimating in this way. But as it turns out, we can do much better, right? If we think of that Hamiltonian as being a statistical model for our system. So if we parameterize that Hamiltonian we're trying to learn by some vector x, now it's just a special case of parameter estimation. Given some data, given some observations, what should I believe that parameter vector to be? We want an approach to this problem that works for small devices, large devices, current experiments, and the experiments we're trying to build. So the punchline, and what I'll get to at the end, is that we're building an algorithm here that can characterize even at the 50 qubit scale. So here I've taken a nearest neighbor an exponentially decaying Ising chain, and said, I don't know what those frequencies are. And this is a problem that the algorithms I'll be talking about here can actually address. To get there, we're gonna need actually a few different tools. We'll build up piece by piece. So we'll start off with some analytic approaches. We'll use those to motivate ideas called rejection filtering, and then we'll generalize that to get the particle filter. We'll generalize even further to get likelihood-free particle filtering. Then we'll add physics to it, and we'll get something that has quantum in the name. But all of these really come back to the same place. We have to start by saying what the likelihood function is that we're trying to learn about. So in the earlier example, we had a state, evolved it under Hamiltonian, measured, and Born's rule told us this is a probability. And in fact, it's a probability for every possible outcome, for every possible model omega, and for every experiment T that we could perform. And once we have this likelihood function, it's the basis for both maximum likelihood and Bayesian approaches to parameter estimation. I'll be talking about Bayesian approaches here, but importantly in this, I have to say frequentist methods work, Bayesian methods also work. Our choice of methodology really should be informed, not by, you know, ideology or what arguments we want to get into, but what the question we have about our system is. So for instance, if I say something like, what should I believe my model to be given my experience with that system and given some observations I've made, that's a Bayesian question, so it'll motivate a Bayesian answer. And those are the kinds of questions I'm talking about here. When I have a question like that, the likelihood function tells us what we learn from that data given our previous experience. So if I say, here's my prior, some probability distribution over that vector that describes the model I'm trying to learn, then that the distribution conditioned on an outcome D is given by multiplying by that likelihood function that I described earlier up to a normalization constant that is annoying, but for the most part, we won't have to worry terribly much about. And once we have that, we can then estimate a particular model vector that is our what we believe that vector to be based on this evidence by taking an expectation value over that posterior. And this is optimal if we commit to penalizing ourselves for wrong statements using the mean squared error. If we say this is how we will cost ourselves, then you can't actually do better than this. So it also works well in the case of KL divergence and several other loss functions. And even if it's not optimal, it tends to be approximately optimal. So we'll keep going with this. It's an iterative algorithm. So when I get this posterior for a datum, then I can iterate back, call that the prior for my next datum, feed that into the likelihood, and get another posterior that describes what happens after to my state of knowledge after I've seen multiple pieces of data. And we can formalize this intuition as an iterative algorithm. So if I input a prior here, a data set, capital D, and the likelihood function describing my model, I'll start by calling my the distribution that is the state of this algorithm, I'll initialize that from my prior. And then for each datum that in that data set, we'll update that distribution by multiplying by the likelihood function and renormalizing. And then after we've done that for each of those data, we will return an estimate by integrating over the final posterior distribution. And in each step, the state of this algorithm also encodes information about our uncertainty. So we're not just keeping a running tally of an estimate. We're keeping more information than that. We're keeping the whole posterior distribution. So if I take an expectation value, for instance, of the squared error, then I get the variance of the posterior. So knowing the variance of that posterior tells me how well I'm doing. And we can use this to make adaptive decisions as well. So I could say, let's pick the next experiment to be the thing that on average over the data that I will observe minimize my uncertainty. And if we do this in the example of the Robbie-Ramsey estimation example I showed earlier, we can analytically find what the posteriors are if we assume a Gaussian prior, and then use that to adaptively choose times. And that's what gives us this thick line here that goes down, you know, some 20 orders of magnitude better than the conventional approach is based on Nyquist sampling. So importantly, this is 120 bits of data. We're sticking in the one-shot limit of that example earlier and doing very well using this sort of an adaptive rule. Even if we just do something with an improved sampling, so do exponentially sparse sampling instead of Nyquist, we still get a massive improvement from thinking of it in terms of a parameter estimation problem. We run into limitations, though, in that we can't do something quite that nice for more generic models. That integral may be intractable. That normalization term actually starts to get really annoying in that now you have an integral with an integral inside it. And for anything more complicated than this, we wind up having to pay a pretty large cost to analytically compute updates for different likelihood functions. So we'll instead numerically approximate these integrals, and this is efficient with Monte Carlo integration if we have a way of sampling from the posterior. One tool to do that is rejection sampling. So given samples from our prior and a likelihood function, rejection sampling gives us a way to sample from a posterior. In particular, we'll drop some samples from our prior and then accept them, call them samples from our posterior with a probability given by that likelihood function. And then the accepted samples are then distributed according to the posterior. Graphically, if I take a prior from 0 to 1 and I multiply by this, and I want to multiply that by this likelihood function we described earlier, then I can put down a bunch of samples from 0 to 1 and pick a bunch of numbers from 0 to 1 to represent the probability of accepting them, and we'll keep the ones that lie under that curve. If I look at the histogram, it does a pretty good approximation of sampling from that sinusoid. So it's a really useful tool, not useful enough. We've still got to do more. And in particular, the problem here is that the likelihood function goes to 0 as we collect more data. As I say, the data set gets bigger and bigger. Likelihood function exponentially approaches 0. This is easy to see if we have a bias coin that we're trying to learn the bias of, and we know it's nearly fair, then the likelihood function for any set of flips is going to be approximately 1 over 2 to the number of flips. So we're only accepting exponentially few samples. We're penalizing exponentially hard for taking more data. So we need to do something better. Let's use Gaussians. All right, so for each datum, we'll now use rejection sampling only to approximate moments for that datum. So instead of trying to do a whole data set, we'll write down what the moments are, posterior moments are for one update. And then at the next iteration, instead of trying to accept or reject those samples, we'll draw new prior samples from a Gaussian matching the moments of our previous posterior. And this means that we're only up doing rejection sampling on one datum at a time, and it keeps our acceptance probability approximately constant. So we're no longer penalizing for taking data for learning. We can compute those posterior moments from one sample at a time using accumulation registers. For example, we could keep the sum of x and the sum of x squared. Turns out that's not numerically stable, but it's pretty easy to modify using a technique known as Welford's algorithm. It's just a lot of additional notation, but the idea is the same, right? We keep a couple registers, increment those, and we don't have to remember the individual samples. So when we put this all together, it gives us a very nice filtering algorithm. We can say a mean, say what our initial covariance is, how many samples we want to accept as a quality parameter, and then for each datum and experiment that we want to update from, we'll initialize the Welford algorithm registers, and then until we see enough samples, we'll draw a new sample from the prior mean and covariance, we'll accept it with using rejection sampling, and if it's accepted, we'll only use it to update those Welford registers and then throw it away. Once we have enough samples, we can estimate new posterior moments, call those our prior moments, and reiterate away. This is easy to implement. It's easy to embed in control hardware. It only needs a constant amount of memory. It's about 5 lines in your favorite language, and it works. So we can see this in particular with the example of phase estimation, where here we'll prepare a state with some unknown eigenphase of some unitary u. And we want to be able to do measurements to learn what that unknown phase is. So if I do a Hadamard here, not Hamiltonian, and invert by some theta, and then do a controlled rotation of the unitary that we're trying to characterize, the eigenphases of, do another Hadamard and measure, we get a likelihood function that is very similar to the frequency estimation likelihood function we saw earlier. except now our time is integer valued and we have this additional inversion we can do. And this algorithm, this likelihood matters to a lot of different applications. It again matters to metrology, also used a lot in interferometry. It gives us a way of calibrating gates and making very robust gates. But it's also useful as a component in near-term quantum simulation and quantum chemistry algorithms, such that improvements here have dramatic consequences on the resource costs for near-term applications of quantum information. And when we apply rejection filtering to it, we can do very well. So sitting up here is Kitaev's phase estimation algorithm, kind of bread and butter textbook approach. And this is for 50, 100, and 400 different accepted samples per datum, how well rejection filtering does. And we can get very close to the known optimum for this, in fact, with, again, small numbers of experiments to get quite a good median error. Yes?
So you have median losses on that?
That's right. Yes, it would. And part of the trouble is in, so the question was, this plot says median rather than mean, would that change the result? And it does. So this is a numerical approximation, and there is a chance of failure. And the trouble is that those failures tend to look like outliers, such that if you measure the mean, you get things that are not very characteristic of the actual performance of the algorithm. And in this case, we have reset rules and things like that that we can use to formally exclude outliers when we apply it in practice, but it's a little difficult to say. So most of the time we look at median just to try and cut out some of the outlying cases. If you look at means and you take many, many, many runs of this algorithm, it tends to look better, it tends to look closer to the median, but for a small number of trials, you have a pretty high probability of getting something that messes up your estimation of the performance of the algorithm. Does that answer? Cool. So this again has its own drawback. It's a very useful algorithm, but it does still require that we assume that the posterior after each datum be approximately Gaussian. We're no longer assuming that everything's Gaussian, just the state of the algorithm. But even that can be a bit of a limitation, so we want to generalize by weakening that Gaussian assumption, and then generalizing the rejection sampling step to keep more information in our filter. The primary tool used to do this is called the Lewestre sampler. So here, if we remember each sample, instead of just throwing it away if we accept it, then we can use that to relax the assumption of Gaussianity. So the Lewestre sampler is parameterized by two real numbers, A and H, whose squares sum to one. And then we pass in the distribution we would like to reapproximate, resample. We'll start in the same way as normal by estimating the mean and covariance of that distribution we're trying to resample from. We'll draw a parent sample from that distribution. And then we'll draw just some other epsilon with the same covariance as the distribution we're trying to approximate. We'll return a new sample that's a linear combination of the original sample, the mean, and this extra bit of noise we added, epsilon. That may seem mysterious, but the reason it works is because it matches the first two moments. If you run through the expectation value, the noise term drops away, and so we're left with A plus one minus A times the mean, preserves the mean. The covariance, the mean drops away, and now we have the parent sample and that noise term we added, they're independent, so the covariance is simply add. Because we chose a squared plus h squared equals one, we've preserved that moment as well. And effectively, this means that we've mixed our original approximation with one minus a of a Gaussian matching the same moments. And now we can see that rejection filtering is a special case of this, where we've taken a to go towards zero. So that is, we've assumed the density at each step is a Gaussian. As we go to A equals one, we get the celebrated bootstrap filter, but we tend to sit around A being 0.98, as it works very well in a wide range of classical applications, most notably finance. And it corresponds to mixing in about 2% of a Gaussian every time. So that we're still assuming that things are somewhat close, but we can keep a lot of the deviations away from that approximation, and it makes us a lot more robust. The other change we'll make is we won't consider samples anymore, but particles, which is just a fancy name for a sample with a weight on it. So a real number between 0 and 1, our expectations now become weighted sums, our covariances now become weighted sums. And in particular, even more, like any arbitrary function of the model vector that we're trying to estimate, we can take weighted sums of that a function evaluated at the different particles, and that corresponds to saying that our distribution at each step looks like a weighted sum of delta functions called particles. We now have an ambiguity that we didn't have with samples, and that we can represent a distribution either with the weights or with the positions. Yeah, the weights or the positions. Here I've represented the same distribution, a multivariate normal distribution, mean zero, covariance one. And you can much more clearly see the structure if we store things in the positions, even with a smaller number of particles. Because most of the particles over here have such low weight, they're not really contributing to telling us about the structure. So we get more freedom out of adding weights, but we really want to sit back over where we were with positions. And this is what the particle filter does for us. We draw our initial samples from our prior, assign them uniform weights, then instead of resampling, we update the weights by multiplying by the likelihood function. That annoying term in the denominator is now just setting those weights to sum to one. And we can periodically use LUEST to move the information that we've stored in the weights back to the positions and preserve numerical stability. In practice, we can see how it works. We've taken here an example of, instead of one cosine function, the product of two cosine functions. And you can see the Bayes update reweighting things and then periodically LUEST kicking in and contracting all the particles toward the mean, effectively rediscretizing based on our current information. And so we see that it's exploring quite well down where the true value that we chose for this example is. It's useful for the Robbie and Ramsey experiments that I mentioned. It's useful for characterizing superconducting qubits. It's also useful in quantum information more generally for tomography, randomized benchmarking, analyzing homodyne measurement, and for doing interferometry and metrology experiments again. In practice, we'll need to add a couple little details here to really make it a practical algorithm. We need error bars, we need time dependence, and we want the implementation to not take the focus off of the algorithmic thinking and off of doing the experiment. Error bars we get almost for free. We have a bunch of particles. We can then either put a covariance ellipse, we can put a convex hull around them, but all of these are descriptions of credible regions, which is a region that says at least alpha of those weights are contained within there, so at least the probability that the true model is within that region is at least alpha. And there's some trade-offs between how simple these are to describe to somebody else, how well they respect the boundaries of our model, but there's a variety of different ways that depend on what you want to report that we can do quite easily from this. Time dependence, we also get almost for free. We can move the particles each time we do a Bayes update, and this allows us to track time-dependent processes, even ones that are highly deterministic, but just not included in our model. So here we've set a Bayes coin, said it evolves under a two-tone function, and assumed it's just a random walk, and a random walk is biased toward that deterministic function by the Bayes update, such that we can see and diagnostically say, we should revise our model to include that. For things which are actually stochastic, we can follow them quite well. So again, with our favorite frequency estimation model, we can track that frequency as it changes in time with very small amounts of data. For software implementation, we've provided a library that is written in Python, works with multiple different languages, and takes the focus off of the implementation back on what we want to be doing, which is theory and experiment. But all of this aside, this is useful in small systems, it's useful now, but we want more. We want more than useful now. We want useful in big systems, we want useful in the kinds of things we're trying to build. So let's push on and see what goes wrong. Well, first thing that goes wrong is it's expensive. This likelihood call, probability of data given a model and an experiment, looks like a simulation of our data, simulation of the system we're trying to learn about. And we have to do this many thousands of times for each datum. That's not a problem in a small system, but it's straight out and not feasible for a large quantum system. But in a way, this problem is because we've put the cart before the horse. We're saying to build a quantum simulator, we have to simulate the quantum system. No. Let's do better by using quantum simulation resources to do this instead. Where the whole point of building a quantum simulator is they're better at solving this exact problem. To do that, we have to be a little careful about what we mean by the word simulation. So up until now, I've been talking about strong simulation, where you feed in a model, feed in a data set, and you get out the likelihood of that data set for that model. But I could also imagine a weak simulator, and this is much closer to what quantum simulation actually does, where I feed in a model and I get out a data set that is plausible for that model. It's not the data set I had, but it's a data set that is consistent with that likelihood. And this means we now need a likelihood-free method that can use weak simulation instead of strong. We'll start off by replacing the rejection sampling step by one that says we'll now accept the sample in our rejection filter if and only if it produces, our weak simulator produces a datum that agrees exactly with our observation. And doing this in our phase estimation example, we see that with 400 accepted samples, we get exactly the same kinds of median scalings that we're used to, that we love, exponentially decaying errors in the number of data. Awesome. We can do the same for particle filtering, where we now use frequencies from our weak simulator to approximate likelihoods. So we'll say how many times did the data on our weak simulator agree with our observations, divide by the number of calls we had to use, and we get an approximation to the likelihood function at that model. If we apply this in the case of a noisy coin, where we can analytically reason about how well it's possible to do, and this winds up being a good proxy for talking about, say, finite visibility measurement, where that P, the bias of the coin, might be some complex function we don't actually have access to, but we can do with a weak simulator. Then as we take 100 calls or 10 calls or one call for each particle in a particle filtering update, with one call per particle, we approach that asymptotic bound of how well we can learn given a number of weak simulation calls much better. So we don't actually demand much in the particle filtering case out of our weak simulator. We demand effectively one bit of accuracy, and we can still do particle filtering. So let's see this actually used to learn quantum systems. We can learn large quantum Hamiltonians by using our likelihood-free particle filter with quantum interactivity. We'll start off with a state on some device that we're trying to characterize, our untrusted device, and we'll evolve for some time t. We'll swap it over to our trusted quantum resource, our simulator that we know what it does and how it works, and we'll invert that by some hypothesis x minus, and then we'll measure and get a data set that way, and now we can perform weak simulations only on our trusted device by just not doing that swap gate and doing everything on the trusted device directly. And this lets us learn. We can learn Ising models on the complete graph quite effectively for this, even out to, say, 9 qubits with a few hundred experiments. And here we took enough trials that we could actually do things with a mean, and it works quite well. We see, again, the same kinds of exponential decay and error that we saw in the simplest cosine case. The slopes are a bit different, indicating how many parameters there are to learn, but it works. It works even if our model is wrong. So here we said our model is a nearest neighbor model, but there's actually 10 to the minus 4 of a complete graph mixed in for our observations. And then we learn quite well up until the 10 to the minus 4 of the complete graph dominates. So this is squared error, so it appears at 10 to the minus 8 times the number of parameters we've neglected, and those plateaus are right where we would hope that they are. They're where the approximation that we're making dominates over the uncertainty in our current posteriors, and where we really should not be able to learn past that. We can now, because we know it's robust to these kinds of wrong models, use one very important wrong model that we get from physical insight, that information is local in our device. We can use that insight to say, now instead of a large quantum resource probing a large quantum resource, take a small quantum resource and probe a large one, and bootstrap our way up to larger devices, giving us a way of actually reasoning about large quantum systems from fairly small starting points. In particular, we'll take an observable, let it evolve forward in the untrusted device, swap it back over to the trusted device, and let it evolve backwards under a particular hypothesis. The light cones will leak outside the support of the initial observable by some amount. This is how it's an approximation and not exactly correct, but we can bound that approximation quality formally if the Lee-Robinson velocity in our untrusted device is finite. And our model can learn, in that case, quite well. We can then scan our trusted device across the untrusted, running the particle filter only on those parameters supported by that particular scan. And if we do this for that 50-qubit model I described earlier, with an 8-qubit simulator and a 4-qubit observable, we see the same decay in errors, the same exponential decay in the median error with about 500 experiments per scan, giving us about a couple orders of magnitude improvement in our initial uncertainty in this 50-qubit Hamiltonian. So this really shows that filtering gives us a practical way of addressing current experimental tasks, of learning large Hamiltonians when we have large quantum resources, and with physical insight of going even further and developing new statistical algorithms that leverage that physical insight to solve really demanding and challenging problems in quantum information. We can go further. We can include things outside of Hamiltonian learning entirely, like noise processes in homogeneity. We can do model selection to test whether a model at all is correct. And in fact, it's an important note that this whole thing, the whole rejection filtering idea, is a dequantization off of a Bayesian inference algorithm that we developed off of Harrow, Hassett, and Lloyd as well. So I mean, it really shows the value too in, you know, developing these kinds of quantum algorithms for the statistical insight that they produce. And with that, thank you very much for your kind attention and happy to take questions.
Hi, I really enjoyed your presentation and your development. One of the questions that I have, though, as an experimentalist, I don't have any trusted quantum systems.
Right.
And so all of those controlled interactions are exactly the things that I'm trying to get estimates on. So is there a realistic way of applying this technique, or are we stuck with something like gate set tomography?
Well, so one thing that I didn't really get into a lot of detail with this is that we don't actually assume these gates are terribly good, right? I mean, we assume that the errors in those gates are well characterized, but if you have errors in those gates and the Hamiltonians commute, then it just factors out as a constant. If your Hamiltonians don't commute, then it shows up as an effect of T2, and you can continue to learn and improve up to the quality. Up to that effect of T2. For instance, in the commuting case, we tried actually using 90% depolarizing 10% swap gate. And it works 100 times as slow, factors out as a quadratic. You know, so it's robust in that sense, if you're able to include these sorts of experimental details. But the other is in the quantum bootstrapping case, I mean, we coupled here this is schematic, but the example we looked at was the untrusted device being 50 qubits, the trusted being eight. And so there's a large mismatch between the kinds of sizes you need to probe and the kinds of sizes that you are probing with. You know, so if you have a system where you have some small trusted device that maybe simulating it classically isn't terribly hard, you can characterize it by whatever pain and effort, and then use that to do this bootstrapping algorithm, right? That's the...
So thanks for mentioning Pauli models, because that's another one of my pet peeves. Have you tried it with more general error models? that are realistic in the lab, like pulse area errors?
Well, so partially we've decided to largely avoid that for the reason we don't want to make our discussion of this specific to any one particular error model. The whole idea of Bayesian inference as a platform for this, all of those details are included in the likelihood function you use to do the updating, or in the likelihood-free case, in the weak simulator you do use to do the updating. And we've seen in a number of different actual experimental applications that we can add the noise that is particular to that system into that description. But as a general principle, we've avoided trying to say terribly much about that at the risk of not wanting to give the impression that it only works for Pauli models or it only works for dipolar. Like, it's a very general way of thinking about the problem at all.
Thank you.
So I appreciate all the methods you're using to do this Hamiltonian learning. Somehow, I just want to take it down to a very basic level. So I kind of like to ask myself, would I, you know, suppose that the learning process, the outcome of it, my life depended on the outcome, you know, and then I try to listen to the whole thing and think, okay, now you have a process, you talked about characterizing the Hamiltonian for a 50-qubit device, et cetera, and these techniques for assessing the Bayesian methods, et cetera, but I'm unable to convert it to my way of thinking, which is how can I assess whether the model and the Hamiltonian you learn is something I could trust where my life depended on it? How do I think of it that way?
Well, at the risk of being a little blasé, if you want to trust your life on it, that's not a Bayesian question. So it shouldn't have a Bayesian answer. Right? I mean, Bayesian questions tend to be, what works on average? What minimizes the average cost that I will incur? Whereas frequentist methods tend to ask, what do I have to do to minimize the worst possible case that will happen, even at the cost that I'll somehow smear out and make everything else worse instead? Right? So if your life really depends on it, you care very much about the worst case analysis, and this whole way of thinking kind of falls apart at the first step. Because it's just not really, it's answering a particular set of questions. Less blasé, I mean, there is a lot that you can do with model selection to really probe how well your Bayesian answer actually holds by comparing to a larger model. This is something Stephen Van Inck and Robin Blumgehut and Chris Ferry have all done a lot of work on in the quantum setting. You can come up with models that omit parts of your physics, and if that explains better than your model with physical insight, then you've done something wrong. You can abort. In a rejection filtering case, we build that in by explicitly designing experiments that should almost never give zeros, and if they give a zero, we can reason about that in a model selection sense to say, something went wrong, abort. So you can hopefully not have to trust your life on numerical approximation failures because of this rich sort of diagnostics that comes out of this way of thinking.
Hi, I just wonder, could you go back to the slides of likelihood-free filtering?
Sure.
Yeah, could you expatiate a bit why it's likelihood-free? Because by definition, the first line, first equation probability function you show in the slides, basically likelihood function.
So yes, this is a bit of an odd thing that seems to be the case in the literature, as far as I can tell, is the word likelihood-free, the phrase likelihood-free really does have a particular meaning. I don't have access to the likelihood. There is a likelihood. Our system is still described by likelihood, but our algorithm is likelihood-free in that it doesn't get that. Right? So here, the likelihood is only viewed through a weak simulator that can sample it. So we don't actually see that likelihood. It's not a part of our algorithm. But as I write it down on paper and describe how it works, I have to hypothesize that somewhere there really is a likelihood.
But you try to approximate a likelihood.
Exactly. So in this case, we take a likelihood full algorithm and make it likelihood free by building up a numerical approximation and showing that our approach is robust to the errors in doing so.
Yeah, a question related to that. So in your case, when you say the simulated data set is equal to your observations,
right?
So it seems that you're assuming inherent discreteness in D.
So this was in the case where our observations are all 0, 1, And so there's no rule that's more general than that other than, but more generally you do get the, there's a whole field of approximate Bayesian computation where you instead put summary statistics on your data and demand that they agree up to some threshold, and then you reason about the effect of that threshold on. So I mean, it's not that you necessarily only have to say if they're exactly equal. Okay. It's just in the strong measurement case that's sort of the obvious thing to do for that.
I see. So basically some kind of sufficient statistics that you can match, for instance.
Exactly. So the SMC ABC algorithm does exactly that, where you take your observations, you estimate moments of your observations, and then you do rejection sampling in the particle filter based on how close each statistics drawn from each particle approximate the moments of your observations.
So just wondering, computing those quantities, do they introduce inefficiencies in the pipeline of quantum simulation?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last thing.
So, you know, doing those statistical comparisons of, you know, these quantities, would they introduce inefficiencies in the quantum simulation pipeline?
I mean, the most straightforward answer I can give is I don't really know. That's not an area I've thought of terribly much. I would, if you'll allow a guess, I would guess that it would show up in the same sorts of ways as like wrong models and what have you, where it's relatively robust to, but you pay a cost in terms of there might be some plateau where you might be less efficient in learning. Okay. But I really can't say for sure.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, looks like there's no more questions. So let's thank Chris.